Well, hi, everybody. Let's open with a word of prayer. The Lord be with you. Let us pray. God, it's good to be together today at St. Paul's, and it's good to always come around these holy texts and mine them for truths and things that are good news that don't always seem self-evident. As we explore one of the stranger and more kind of coarse stories of your text, may you bring forth life and joy and peace and show us how it is gospel. In Jesus' name, amen. So I'll just say this. There are more of you here this week than were here last week because you're a bunch of weirdos because you wanted to come to the class about circumcision and foreskins. I know you. I know who you are. So we're going to talk today about one of the weirdest stories, truly, that is in the Bible, and that's saying something. And there's lots of weird ones, but this one in particular, this is actually the text that inspired this class, because we were in morning prayer, and sweet Kathleen was just reading it, just earnestly, just like you do, and I was just like, that is the strangest story that was just read, like it wasn't strange at all. So we are going to talk about this weird story that has a mound of foreskins being brought to a king. And then we're going to pivot off that a little bit to talk about kind of some of the war stories in the Bible in general. I want to show you something that is really, really cool. It's a similar kind of observation to the one I offered regarding Pentecost and the golden calf. I don't really know what to do with it. I can see what it's doing, but it's one of those, it's a truth that is embedded in this text that we don't yet know how it plays together. And it's probably worth saying with a lot of these ancient texts, people spend their whole life studying these things, and they'll be like, yeah, we think it means this, but we really don't know. This is especially true of like books like Leviticus, where there's all this ancient legal text about sacrifice and the sacrificial system. And experts are like, it could have meant this, but I don't know. So we're going to enter some of that territory today. Which will be lovely. Next week will be a little more straightforward with the Year of Jubilee. We will be in Leviticus, one of my favorite books. And then last, we'll close out with some of the stuff that even the lectionary won't put in there, those weird passages about the role and place of women. So tell your friends. It'll be fun. So let's start with, again, the invitation to Midrash. If this is your first week in this class, I have been so stoked to teach this class with y'all because your engagement has been so good. What we've been doing is we're reading these stories and then we're approaching them Hebraically. We're approaching them like our brothers and sisters from Judaism do, where they start asking the hardest questions that they've got about these stories. In Judaism, you don't respect the text by not asking questions of it. You respect the text by asking the hardest thing you've got of it. And that's how you show that you honor it and even recognize its authority. So we are going to do that. So we're going to read this story, and then I'm going to ask you, what questions do you have? What sticks out to you? Is there anything upsetting? The answer will be yes. Is there anything so cliche that it has no meaning anymore? I hope not, but it could be. You never know. But let's start. This is a story about two characters that you might be familiar with. David and Saul are involved in this story. What do you already know about David and Saul? Just call it out, and I'll repeat it. They're kings. Who was king first? Yes, so Saul is number one. And then... And David is number two. Yep. Who's the third king that Israel has? Solomon. He doesn't show up in this story, but I'm impressed that you know. Okay. Saul goes a little crazy. Why does he go crazy? Like, what is it that's making him nuts? David, jealousy. It's like this envy and this jealousy is like turning into paranoia, and you see it expressed in murderous rage. We're going to see that today. We're going to come back to that. That's exactly right. The scripture is explicit that they choose Saul as king, and I'm going to talk about the context, because he looks like a king should look, right? Which we all know is an amazing criteria for selecting your leadership. What else? Why is David super famous in Children's Chapel? He kills Goliath, right? And Goliath is of what ethnicity? Yes, yes. Okay. Goliath the Philistine. Okay. So, I'm going to invite you, as you are able, to stand for the reading of these holy texts. You do not have to. You know who you are. This is just an ancient custom. I'm going to show you. If you brought your Bible. Oh my gosh, Barbara Edwards, yes. We are in 1 Samuel 18. So if you brought your Bible, 1 Samuel 18, if you have a notebook you brought with you, make notes about the things that stick out to you, the things that trouble you, the things that are so cliche they have no meaning anymore. And then we will get after this. Okay. 1 Samuel 18, 5 through 30. David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him over the army. And all the people, even the servants of Saul, approved. As they were coming home, when David returned from killing the Philistine, the women came out of all the towns of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul, with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they made merry, "Saul has killed his thousands, and David his 10,000s." Saul was very angry, for this saying displeased him. He said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands? What more can he have but the kingdom?" So Saul eyed David from that day on. That's a heading that isn't part of the text. Saul tries to kill David. The next day, an evil spirit from God rushed upon Saul. He raved within his house. While David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day, Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul threw the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall." But David eluded him twice. Saul was afraid of David, because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him a commander of 1,000. And David marched out and came in, leading the army. David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. When Saul saw that he had had great success, he stood in awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, for it was he who marched out and came in leading them. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my elder daughter, Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines deal with him." David said to Saul, "Who am I and who are my kinsfolk, my father's family in Israel, that I should be the son-in-law to the king?" But at the time when Saul's daughter Merab should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel, them, as a wife. I did not prep that word. And apparently last week I said calamites instead of calamities. Sometimes when you're reading that much Lamentations, you mess it up. Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David. Saul was told, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, "Let me give her to him that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Therefore Saul said to David a second time, "You shall now be my son-in-law." Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to you now then, become the king's son-in-law." So Saul's servants reported these words to David in private. And David said, "Does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, seeing that I'm a poor man and of no repute?" The servants of Saul told him, "This is what David said." Then Saul said, "Thus you say to David, 'The king desires no marriage present except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged on the king's enemies.' Now Saul planned to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines." When his servants told David these words, David was well pleased to be the king's son-in-law. Before the time had expired, David rose and went, along with his men, and killed 100 of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law, like you do. Saul gave him his daughter Michal as a wife. But when Saul realized that the Lord was with David, and that Saul's daughter Michal loved him, Saul was more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy from that time forward. Then the commanders of the Philistines came out in battle. And as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, so that his fame became very great. The word of the Lord. Let's sit for our words. Oh my goodness. So, what are you wondering? What are some of your questions, comments, things that were so cliche they have no meaning? Questions, what do you got? It's kind of, yeah, it feels like that's kind of primitive. Yeah, it's troubling. What else? Why circumcise dead Philistines? I mean, really, isn't that the question at the heart of the text? What else? Yeah, it's totally. Is it because you know how it is? It's like your boss is having a bad day in the office and he just throws a spear at you. Yeah, Ken. Who, Saul? Oh, so like that's why he kills the Philistines? Because, right. Yeah, he wants Philistine foreskins. I know. Is it kind of like, you know, like a scalping thing? Like, yeah. Okay, these are great questions. Yeah. It is easier. It's probably easier than taking 100 heads. I mean, if you're going to bring 100 of any body part, you know, I mean, pick one that you can carry in a sack. All right, I'm going to quit while I'm ahead. These are great questions. Hey, we're just reading the Bible. All right, Lee, what do you got? Oh, did anybody else see that? So Saul wants to send David into battle to get killed, very much like David will later send Uriah into battle. Yes. All right, now we're reading the text. When you see those kind of rings and callbacks, always pay attention to them. It is on purpose. Something is happening. There's even one in here that I just read noticed when we were doing it here. It talks about Saul and David were enemies, you know, from that day forward. Does anybody remember a time where two people were spoken of as developing a relationship in the New Testament from that day forward? There's this weird line in the gospel where it's like Herod and Pilate became friends that day, right? There's something there. I don't know what it is, but there's something there. Okay, so let's talk about some of this. This is so weird. So just a little bit of context, all right? So basically remember that Saul is Israel's king not by God's plan, okay? Israel was meant to be a nation without a king because the Lord is their king. Why? Does anybody remember why they end up with a king? Because they want to be like all the other nations. This is what they asked for. They're like, we want to be like everybody else. Of course, what is their like fundamental raison d'etre, according to the covenant? To be different than everybody else. So this is this move that's like unfaithfulness. This is a move to have a king that is about fitting in and not being distinct, just going with the flow, best practices. Doing what the neighbors are doing, right? And why does God go along with it? Who knows? God tells them, of course, that he's like, I'll give you a king, but it's not going to go well for you. If you get a king, this king is going to oppress you. This king is going to misappropriate your money. This king is going to conscript your young men into battle, and they're going to lose their lives. This is what you will get from a king. And they're like, we want to be like everybody else. Because sometimes staying in the flow is just easier, right? It's what everybody does, right? And so part of what you're seeing in this is God's like, if you want it, I'll give it to you. Don't forget when these stories were written, most of them are written down when the people are in exile, when they've been evicted from the land because of their misbehavior. So part of what you're seeing in these stories is a reckoning with their history. This is a place that our ancestors, we got it wrong. This is what we did. We didn't listen here, you know? So they're writing their own failures into their stories. It's super profound. I'm going to talk about that more in a couple of classes. But this is why they pick Saul. And like Sherry said, when they talk about who they're going to select, they line a bunch of dudes up. Because it had to be dudes at the time. They really do. They pick the one who looks presidential, right? That's the criteria. Like, so from end to end, this has been a terrible idea. And like they have no idea what to look for in a leader, what really matters. But somewhere in the story, we start to realize that God has a plan to redeem this thing. And God's going to do it through David. Nobody else knows this in the story, okay, except Samuel, the narrator, and us. Nobody else knows this in the story yet. So Saul doesn't know it. David doesn't know it. And so he's just sort of watching David succeed over and over again. And for Saul, it's driving him crazy, right? Okay. So basically, Philistia, right, is here. So this is where the Philistines are, right next to Judah, which is where David and Saul are in Jerusalem, right? Underneath Israel. So this is like land that they feel like belongs to them already because it's part of the land that God gave them. And so what you see here is they're always at conflict with the Philistines because of this kind of ancient rivalry that's there. Our story starts after David has killed Goliath and he's starting to like gain stature, right? He's rising, his star is rising and everybody loves him. And as you all rightfully identified, when he comes in and they're singing and dancing and they're making song, he gets promoted over Saul and Saul gets totally jealous and starts to get paranoid, right? You've all seen that happen. Is this anything new that you see this stuff today? No, it's what happens. Actually, this is interesting. Leadership and power of the kind of a king, or even just in general, like leadership, is the result of human sin. It's not how we're supposed to be as people. It's why it messes people up and skews you. Like, it's not part of how God ordered the creation. We weren't supposed to have that. It's kind of like a compensation that we're making. So David comes back from killing all these Philistines, and basically there should be enough, like, celebration to go around. But Saul is insecure, thin-skinned, fearful, and so he starts to get jealous that David wants the throne. And so he basically tries to remove him from his court. Let's get him out of the public view. And so he makes him commander of these armies. Let's get him out. Get him out of here. But of course, then David goes off, and because God is with him, what happens? He thrives, right? He becomes even more famous as this warrior now. So then he comes back, and Saul's like, what if I just throw a spear at him? Like, what if I just kill him outright? And some of that evil spirit language, part of it is I don't know, all right? Part of it is there is a way that the Hebrew writers approach these stories. When God's will is set, like God's face is set on doing something, God will accomplish it regardless of who's against God. Like, you can't stop it. And so there is a way that, like, kind of, this is part of what it meant when, like, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. The hardening of Pharaoh's heart was God wasn't going to stop demanding freedom for Israel. Like, it's not going to stop. They will not be slaves. That is my will. And as Pharaoh resisted it, God kept pushing it. And so God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And I think there's something similar here with, like, this evil spirit coming on. It's like, why is it from God? Like, what is this about? It's because of the movement of God with David and Saul's paranoia, jealousy, fearfulness. So that's how they wrote that stuff. But it's such a good question, and it's weird. I mean, it's weird. God sent an evil spirit. Well, that's convenient. So then basically, because he can't pin David to the wall with a spear, did you have a question about that? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Lucy's saying, could it also just be like a description of the consequence of a sinful life? You know, for example, the more, you know, the less you pursue sobriety, the more crazy you get, right? The more you nurture paranoia and suspicion in your heart, the more anxiety and fear you have. You know, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think it's, we recognize that thing. Like, why would people do stuff like that? You know, they're not in the right mind. For sure. So basically, our story continues where Saul's like offers David Merab, his daughter, to be married, and then kind of withdraws the offer for no reason and like marries her off to somebody else. I don't know what that's about. But then Michal actually wants to marry David, loves him, and so Saul gets this plan, which should sound familiar to us. He's like, okay, I want to get rid of this guy. I want to get rid of David. So this is what I'll do. This is my chance. I'll say he can marry my daughter, and then I'll demand as the bride's price, which is a thing in the ancient world, you would kind of you would bring some sort of offering to the family if you were a man of the woman that you wanted to marry. He's like, for my bride's price, I'm going to ask for foreskins of the Philistines, right? So, a couple of thoughts about that. So, I had a slide, and I kept searching for an image to put on it, and there just wasn't one. And finally, Kristen came in and was like, just shut it down. You don't get to have a slide for this, Dixon. So, this is, my wife edited my slides. So basically, when you, in the ancient world, okay, circumcision was a pretty common custom. It was often a rite of passage. In the middle, the ancient Near East, all the way down to Australia, you find different people, tribes doing it, and it was something that, again, you would find in men as they sort of became of the, or young boys as they came of age to be men, they would undergo this ritual. Now, as Justin pointed out, I think it was Justin earlier, the this ritual had kind of a supercharged meaning for the Israelites because it was central to what it meant for them to be a covenant people with God. You didn't wait till somebody was 13 to do this. You did it on the eighth day of their birth. And it was part of what it, of how you demonstrated your belonging to be God's covenant people. So part of what's going on here, though, is that basically the Philistines were Israel's rival, right? And they're always at war with them. And they were kind of looked down upon by the Israelites, too. Like, they're dirty, they're low class. They're like those Europeans that don't circumcise themselves, right? So we know that they're nasty. So when Saul sends David out to collect their foreskins as the bride's price, are they going to be people that line up to give those willingly? No. No, so what is he basically asking David to go do? Kill a thousand, you know, however many, what's a thousand people, what, no, 100? How many? Yeah, he's like, you're going to have to go kill him. Basically gaming the fact he's thinking, by the time David tries to do this, he's going to get killed. Except God is with David. And so David succeeds. And this is one of the like grosser, coarser stories of the Bible because you kind of are supposed to get this picture of David like counting them out. Wait, I lost my place. Okay, start over, right? I mean, like, it's really weird, and, like, he had to kill him to take the foreskins. So it's not an imposition of ritual. It's very much about Saul trying to figure out how to get rid of this guy. Ironically, of course, you all recognized this is exactly what David does to Uriah in order to be with Bathsheba, right? Except David again succeeds where Saul fails, right? That's some dark irony. That is the Bible right there. Coarse humor, dark irony, that's all through it. So basically, they're not going to voluntarily give up these foreskins, kind of an over my dead body. So Saul's plan is like a win-win. Either David gets killed and he's happy, or he gets to assert his dominance over the Philistines and everyone sees him as a hero. But David succeeds so much so that, again, he is celebrated even in the middle of this. And so Saul further descends into paranoia and suspicion, and they are enemies from this day forward. So that is this weird story, right? That's super funky, isn't it? The question that you might want to ask is, why are they at war with anybody? Like, why is Israel at war with anybody to begin with? And this is something cool that I want to show you. So I should say, questions about the foreskins first. It's good. Okay. It's so weird. It's so weird. That's why we don't read it on Sunday. Okay. So I want to show you something really, really cool. These stories in the ancient world about celebrating killing, as Janice mentioned, they're super troubling, right? And they're weird. And there's a lot going on with them where in the ancient world, it was a tribal mentality, right? This is how you lived. It was kill or be killed, you know? And so, you know, and we talked about this in my Bible class earlier this year, you know, when you had kids, you know, did you have ward because you needed more soldiers for your army? You know, did you need more hands to work the farm? Yeah. It's like, no, we kind of like live in this culture where we don't have to like reproduce for practical reasons like that, but in the ancient world they did. And so there was this sense like, we got to build up our fortifications, because, you know, these other tribes that are out there, they will come and take what is ours if we don't defend it. And so you had this very sense of, like, tribes were about their own center of gravity. Tribes were about protecting what they had and keeping it to themselves. What's interesting is in the middle of that sensibility, that consciousness, you have this new thing that happens where God speaks to Abram and says, I want you to be a different kind of tribe. You're going to have your own tribe. You don't have one yet. I'm going to give you a tribe. Except your tribe is going to be blessed to be a blessing. You are going to have resource and gifts and skills, not for yourself and to dominate the other tribes. You will be the tribe that is for all the other tribes, right? And so what you see as this tribe moves forward is it behaves like tribes did in the ancient world, at least as these stories are told, right? They're going into battle. They're fighting because that's what you did. It's how things were. It's barbaric and it's primitive. Yeah, it totally is. But you know what else is in these same stories? The command to love your neighbor as yourself. That's from Leviticus. That's wild in the ancient world. Insane. The command to not harvest your field all the way to the corners, leave the corners for the poor and the alien. That's in these same stories. That's really progressive. The call explicitly, again in Leviticus, to treat foreigners, immigrants, and aliens as if they had been among you the whole time. They're never to be demonized, run off, exploited. They are to be cared for as if they belonged to you. That is a really difficult idea still for us to deal with today, right? Because we're so advanced. So you find in these stories like new ideas and old ideas commingling all the time. And yes, they're primitive and barbaric, but all the way through, you see God like pulling everybody kind of one click forward, one click forward. Like as, and you see in these stories, human consciousness about what God is all about expanding and like them getting, oh my gosh, this is what God's like? This is what God's like? So if that's true, you might say, why doesn't this, all this like genocide stuff that God calls the people to do, get addressed by Jesus? Like, why doesn't he stand up and go, by the way, genocide stuff, not cool. I'm going to down the cross. Like, it's kind of how it's going to be about self-sacrificial love, not about dominance. Jesus never says that, right? Or does he? So there's a story in Matthew where Jesus encounters a woman whose daughter's possessed by a demon, all right? And they're in the wilderness at Tyre and Sidon, and which is like pagan land. And she comes up to Jesus, and she's like, Jesus, you got to hear my little girl. And he doesn't say anything to her. And then she asks him again, you got to heal my little girl. And he says, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Why does he tell you that? Because she's not an Israelite. What kind of woman is she? Well, she's a Canaanite woman in Matthew. Now, what's interesting about this is that Mark's gospel also has this story, and she's named as the Syrophoenician woman. Most of you probably know the story as she's the Syrophoenician woman. This gospel, the only gospel that has a story that mentions her as a Canaanite woman. That's a very specific choice. And it wasn't part of like scholars believe that Mark was written first and like parts of Mark were borrowed from Matthew. They're like, is Matthew like doing something? Is there like a change that's on purpose here? And she basically says to him, she calls out for mercy, and Jesus says, I'm sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. And she says, but Lord, help me. And he answered, it's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. And she said, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered her, oh woman, great is your faith, be it done for you as you desire. And her daughter was instantly healed. Okay, so like I said, same story in Mark. She's a Syrophoenician woman, not a Canaanite woman. However, notice some of the details that Matthew has in his version of the story. I emboldened them. She's Canaanite here. Did I put it in there? No. She asks, where is it here? She asks for, have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. Okay? Everybody following these details? All right, let me see if I can do this on slides. It's easier when you have Bibles, so Barbara will be in good shape here. All right, so kind of like my sermon this morning, the context of a story can really matter in its interpretation in a gospel, like where it's laid, how it's set out, okay? These are not just sort of like abstract stories that exist to be pulled objectively. They're always part of a whole, okay? So the stories that happen immediately before this woman, the Canaanite woman, being shown mercy and Jesus healing her daughter in Matthew, the story before it is the feeding of the 5,000, right? You guys know this story. It's depicted up here, okay? But have you ever noticed how there's two versions of this story in Matthew's gospel? There's like the feeding of the 4,000 as well, right? That's kind of weird. Like, why? I don't know. What are you doing? Are you just trying to like rub our face in it that Jesus can multiply food? Like, what's the deal, you know? So if the feeding of the 5,000 is where this thing starts, does anybody remember how many baskets of bread are left over in the feeding of the 5,000 story? 12. That's right. 12 is a super famous number in the scriptures. What does it signify? The 12 tribes of Israel. All right, so in all of the feeding stories where Jesus is like providing bread for people in the wilderness, there's Exodus overtones in all of them. You're supposed to be like, oh yeah, this is like what God does. God feeds the people in the wilderness. God offers the bread. There's 12 baskets left over. There's enough for all the 12 tribes. So this is about very much the way that God is providing through Jesus the new Exodus, the new kind of bread, but it's going to be better than the manna in the wilderness. It's going to be Jesus himself. He is the bread of life. You've heard this before. We read like 4 or 5 weeks of it in the lectionary on Sunday mornings. All right? So here's what's interesting. When you get to the feeding of the 4,000, right, how many baskets are left over? Hint. 7 baskets are left over. What is that about? What does 7 make you think of? Bible stuff. There's the number of completeness, 7 times 7 with forgiveness. So because why? Think everything goes back to Genesis. What's 7 in Genesis? The 7 days of the original creation. The wholeness of the original creation. So like there's 7 baskets from this 4,000. Well, that's really interesting, right? Is this about some sort of completeness, some sort of wholeness? Or is it also about something else? What's the story that happens in between these two feeding miracles? I just told you, it's the story of the Canaanite woman, right? Which is, she's called Canaanite. She's asked to have mercy, right? So these should set your mind off, because all of you, as good Jews, know that in Deuteronomy 7, when the genocide that God asked the people to do is commanded, it goes like this. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, 7 nations larger and stronger than you. And when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, you must destroy them totally, make no treaty with them, and show them no mercy. And yet here we have a Canaanite woman asking Jesus for bread, which we know he can provide, being shown mercy, and immediately following that, we have a feeding miracle with 7 baskets. Are the 7 baskets symbolic of these 7 nations that were called to be eradicated in Deuteronomy? Is this a taking of the genocide tradition in Jesus' own people and a turning it on its head? Is Jesus saying, or actually is Matthew saying and using the Jesus story to be like, this is not how it works anymore? And I know this is troubling, and I'm going to write into this story with the way that Jesus does this with these feeding miracles. I'm going to show you how God is redeeming this posture. This is not how it will work any longer. I don't know. I might be wrong. But that's kind of cool, isn't it? Isn't that like super interesting? I find it so, so powerful, especially that she's asking for bread and mercy. And it's a prefiguring, obviously, of like the Gentile inclusion into the kingdom. That's like part of what the Canaanite woman story is about, is seeing, oh yeah, this gospel is for everybody, not just the Israelites. And yet there's a very particular way the story gets told that calls back to Deuteronomy 7, I think, as a way of offering a redemptive perspective on the genocide war stories. Yelly? No. So one of the things you have to remember, so Lee's asking, like, does this mean, like, didn't God start this whole genocide thing? Is this like, did God change his mind? God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. We are not, right? and we are figuring stuff out as we move through, you call it, you know, we're kind of like expanding consciousness about what it means to be in relationship with this God and to be human beings that body forth this God's life and will in the world. And so I think when you see stories about genocide in the ancient world, actually, literally, it's like ancient trash talk. Like it's the way that you said, because there's stories about like the Philistines totally eradicating the Israelites and destroying them. Well, we know that didn't happen. Why do they write that? Because it's like pro wrestling. I'm going to tear you apart. I'm going to come at you. Like this is like the way that nations would talk about themselves. So the stories are not always like, they're not camcorder history, and they are not speaking for God. Like it's one of the worst questions that you can ask when it comes to the Bible, and it's a popular one, is why did God do this? Why did God do that? I mean, it's a fair question, right? You want to ask it. What's the problem? God didn't write the Bible with a fountain pen. You have people witnessing to things about God. So the better question is not, why did God do this? Why did God command genocide? Who can speak for God? Like, what we have is a text that people felt was so important, those stories, that they wrote them down. So the better question is, why did people write this story down? What was it about this story that they really needed to capture and know and keep with them? That's the thing, because it's not a camcorder witness of like this, and then God did this, and then God did this, and we have a newspaper account. Like that's us, we kind of read that perspective back onto these stories because of our modern categories. So does that make sense, Leah? I mean, it's a little bit of a can of worms, and we can go deeper too, but okay, oh my gosh, it's late, and I got to go preach. All right, so I offer this to you. Bless you. Thank you. I hope you don't feel weird. If you need to go wash your hands, I get it. Next week, we'll talk about the year of Jubilee. Go in peace, to love, and serve the Lord.